Okay, welcome to the Stage Left podcast, lifting the veil on the music industry by telling the stories of those with a unique vantage point. On this episode, we chat to writer, academic, senior lecturer, and former guitarist in Sleeper, John Stewart. Today, we'll be finding out how John went from being a philosophy student playing guitar in the halls of residence of Manchester Uni to having a song covered by the great Elvis Costello and supporting the likes of REM, Manic Street Preachers, and Radiohead. We'll also hear how his music appeared on the soundtrack to Trainspotting, what it was like being centric to the whirlwind of Britpop, and the difficulties that can arise when being in a band with a complex set of personal relationships. We'll also find out how John now passes on his wisdom and experience to those entering the music industry in his role as a highly respected university senior lecturer, and about his role as music supervisor in the film Telstar, the Joe Meek story starring Kevin Spacey. So it's a pleasure to say my guest today on the Stage Left podcast is John Stewart. Thanks for joining us today, John. How's it going?
Very good, thank you. It's great to see you again. I love it when former students graduate and go off and do interesting things, and you're absolutely doing that. So this is a real total joy for me to be doing this, and thank you very much for asking me on.
Great, thanks, John. So today you're involved in a graduation ceremony. Are you hosting it, or are you just kind of sitting at the side?
I'm going to be sitting on stage, and when a few of my students come up, which is the music business students that I've been looking after, I'll be giving them or announcing them, and then they'll be getting their degrees. Yeah, so it's a pretty exciting day. There's lots of people running around panicking because the door's about to open, and we're hiding away in a dressing room under the Brighton Dome, which is where, speaking of the music business, ABBA won with Waterloo the Eurovision Song Contest.
Yeah, really?
Yes, this is it.
Really?
And also Pink Floyd played Dark Side of the Moon for the first time before it was released in its entirety, I believe. All in these dressing rooms. So at some point, one night, however many years ago, 50 years ago, probably 74, was it the other thing, I think?
Yeah.
Someone would have come down in and gone, right, Benny, Bjorn, you're on. Away you go. And they would have gone up and done the Waterloo.
Wow, that's crazy.
So if we hear any background noise, it's the ghosts of ABBA.
Excellent. And is Roger Daltrey here? He done the last couple, didn't he?
He's not here today. He's got meningitis. He was going to be on tour in America, so he couldn't have done it anyway. There is a surprise guest, not at liberty to say who it is.
Oh, okay, that's fine. Out of interest, do you get kind of nerves addressing people in public? You know, you've done a lot of kind of public performance. You know, you've played in front of like 80,000 people at concerts and stuff. Any of those skills been transferable when addressing large groups of people?
That's a really, really good question, actually. And now I teach at BIM. One of the very interesting elements to me, having trained a lot of teachers, is the former performers that are often some of the best teachers. And it's an interesting dynamic because you have to be not sufficiently self-centered that you can actually engage with your audience, which is what teachers have to do, whereas performers, the more self-centered you are, the better in a lot of ways. So you need that element of I'm not totally self-centered, but you also need that element of I'm able to step out of myself, my normal, I suppose, shell, and go into stage mode, which is essentially what a lot of really good teachers do for an hour whenever they're giving particularly a big class. And it's the people that can do that. Some of the most knowledgeable people that haven't been performers find it difficult to teach in groups larger than sort of 10 or 12. So I've never thought of it technically as a transferable skill, but that's exactly what it is.
Cool. And I'm going to begin with a quote, and you're going to know where this quote is from. It's from Hunter S. Thompson. The music business is a cruel and shallow money trench, a long plastic hallway where thieves and pimps run free and good men die like dogs. There's also a negative side. What's your view seeing these kids graduate? Because you've had a very interesting story, a lot of kind of roller coaster story in the music industry and stuff like that. Given some of your own experiences, is there kind of a slight kind of thing on your shoulder saying, oh, do you really want to go into the music industry and stuff like that?
You know, that's a really interesting question. It's one that I think anybody who's honest about themselves, who teaches in any form of arts education, wrestles with on a daily basis. And if they don't, then they're not being fully honest with themselves. They're living in a dream world. So that issue of transferable skills that we just talked about is entirely relevant. Again, what I think of as teaching is not so much how to be a musician or how to be a rock star, but general transferable skills. Like I taught, this is why I taught research methods and analytical thinking and music history and philosophy of popular music, because a lot of my students see those as the least important classes. For me, they're the most important, because you can use research methods to research how to play a mode correctly or whatever, but you can also use it to research anything, such as where you're going with your career. And for me, it's absolutely essential that people gain, whilst they're at university, all those kind of transferable skills like critical thinking and data gathering, that they can then use whatever they do. Because the truth is, most, or a good proportion of students that arrive at any art school, whether it's a theatre school or a film school or a music school, won't end up doing exactly what they want to do. They'll end up doing something related to that. And it's how you're able to be flexible and how you're able to approach those different decision points that arrive at you in life, and how you're able to deal with things when they don't go well. That's what's really the key element. So that's kind of what I try and include in there.
So what was your ambition when you went to uni to do the philosophy degree? Is it where you are now?
Yeah, pretty much actually. It was, I wanted to do anything to do with music, and I loved politics and philosophy, which was my degree. It was politics and modern history, but I basically studied political philosophy. And to me, doing anything to do with music would have been a victory. And also, I loved study and discussing things and having ideas and how ideas shape things. So what I'm doing now really is a perfect fit, and very, very happy to be doing it, and feel grateful every morning when I get up for work, to be honest, which is a wonderful place to be.
Yeah, I mean, you're highly respected in your field, and I know that I actually spent most of the weekend reading Louise Werner's Different for Girls book.
Yes, excellent.
So things got pretty wild there. What a great book. I recommend it for anybody who's... It's a great, great book. It's quite short, and it's but very detailing a kind of crazy couple of years for you guys. And so you were at university in Manchester, is that right? And so you were a philosophy student, and you'd already written songs before uni, I believe, and you were kind of... You knew a lot about kind of song compositions, and so you were kind of very much the driving force between the dreams that Louise had and the professional reality, which is something you do now. You are kind of that bridge, kind of...
That's a really good way of putting it. That's wonderful. This feels like a bit of a therapy session. That's fantastic. I should be paying you for this. £50 an hour.
Really? Okay. Okay, so... You'd already written these songs, and you know, when you started up the bands, it struck me when I read the book that you had a kind of very fixed idea of the type of music you were into, and your craft work and stuff like that. Reading Louise's kind of view on it, she was very much kind of wanting to chase the kind of pop stardom. I've got a great quote from her here, which is, "I'm dying to sell out. Here I am, sell me, I'm yours. You lot play to people and one man and a dog in a pub for the rest of your lives if you want to, but I want to meet David Bowie." How did you feel at that time?
Well, I was very keen on playing to one man and a dog in a pub, and didn't want to do the sellout element. And she had a much better vision of it in terms of the commercial realities of it than I did. So I was a philosopher trying to be in a band, and she was far more of a popular culture person. Louise was really, really smart in a lot of different ways. One of the best ways you can tell that with a songwriter particularly is if they coin phrases that enter the sort of common lexicon. And when she coined the phrase "in betweener," which already existed but was almost unheard of, and she said to me, we wrote a song together, and she said, "I want to call it In Between." And I was like, "That's a made up word. You can't possibly do that," which I now know is a neologism. And she said, "Well, I think it worked." So we went with it. And now there's a TV series called In Between Us and a movie. Well, that Louise coined that.
Yeah.
Another one is The It Girl. Yeah. She said, "I want to call this album The It Girl." And that phrase hadn't been used probably since the 1930s. And I was like, what the hell's an It Girl? And again, the notion of an It Girl came into common parlance with that album. So I think Louise was right. I suppose it was a fortuitous combination of two sort of dreamers with different but interconnected ideas that got a record deal. And a lot of it's luck, but also a lot of it is having the judgment to see where culture's going at any particular time, and we were able to do that between us. For example, there hadn't really been a girl front of band or a female front of band, as I now describe it, since probably Blondie that had really, really broken through. There were a couple, but they hadn't really, it hadn't become a thing. And we could see there was a whole bunch of them vying for attention, many of whom you'd never hear of today because they didn't get deals, or some who got deals and then kind of did okay, like, you know, Salad or whatever, and then some who got deals and did really well, like Elastica or us or Echo Belly. And we could see that that was coming, and everybody could see it was coming. So that's kind of what your job is as a musician, is to see what's coming. And that's what's really hard. And you, in order to be able to do that, you need to have some understanding of where things have been, an understanding of demographics, an understanding of technology. And you need to be able to see gaps in culture that can be filled, because that's what successful arts projects are. They're things that combine current thinking with new thinking and fill a gap. I mean, one of my best favourite examples is Banksy. The dude took graffiti, which was pre-existing, played with the idea of what does it mean to own a piece of artwork? Can you have a £10 million piece of artwork on a commonly owned wall? Used instant tools to create it, spray cans. It's very, very simple because it's using spray cans, which also matches the idea of the internet meme, so it translates interestingly with that. And that's why Banksy's the most important artist in the UK today. And that's what you have to do in any form of art. You have to be able to go, okay, what's happening? What can I do that correlates with that and puts a new spin on it?
Because you're doing lots of different things. I know you're stuck in a rut and you're obviously signing on and you're moving on a lot. I think you even went over to America and was like, you were singing waiter, is that right?
That's both right, yeah. We did an exchange program after we left university in the United States, and we worked as singing waiters on a boat in Boston Harbor called the Spirit of Boston.
What did you learn from that experience?
I learned how brilliant American pop music performers are. They'd all been to music schools just like Bim. They were all amazing. I also learned how energetic the live music industry in the United States is. There's a lot more function band type work going. I mean, you know, a singing waiter on a floating restaurant, it doesn't get much better. I'd do that today if I could. It was fantastic. And I learned how much Americans love British culture. Because to be a young British guy on a boat with lots of sort of Americans entertaining themselves and getting drunk at the open bar really does open your eyes to the value of British culture, whether it's the impact the Beatles had or James Bond or any of those guys. There's a cultural relationship there that's a product of this kind of massive international collision of, that's now 500 years old, and in a time when a lot of what we think of as having value has disappeared over my lifetime, like the industry in this country, whether it's the steel industry where I'm from in Sheffield or the car industry in the Midlands. The British cultural industry, which goes back to your original question, the British cultural industry has stood out and withheld its value, and that's because it's really good. What we do in this country in terms of popular music is really good. And it has credibility. But I also learned that what Americans do as performers is really good. Their chops are really good. And there's some amazing, brilliant songs out there that come from a kind of combination of African-American culture, Jewish-American New York songwriting culture. It's a fantastic cultural collision that's made popular music what it is today, I believe. So to see that in action, the band did covers from the disco era and some amazing tunes. Best of My Love was one. To see that done every night by a really good covers band was incredible. And they were all studying at the Boston equivalent of BIM at the time.
Right.
I was like, how did you guys get so good? And they're like, we'll go to school. And I didn't realise you could go to school and study this. There weren't any popular music schools in the UK at that time.
Yeah, strange now. I know that obviously we kind of mentioned that you kind of morph in little bits of fit styles, and at the age of 25, I think Louise said, the pop clock was ticking.
Yes.
And you did something brilliant, which is totally genius, which I think really helped your kind of... you get found, which is, I think you designed a fake enemy review.
Yes, that was our marketing
genius.
So this was at a time when Microsoft Word was still a new thing, and Louise or her brother Jeff, who managed the band, discovered a guy who had a computer with Word on it, and he could change fonts and match fonts. And we were desperately trying to get some attention in the press, and we got a review in the Jewish Chronicle or something like that, or the Hammond High, which was the Highgate newspaper, which was kind of a middling review. And I was like, oh, this is never going to happen. And I was some Essex local newspaper, and we just thought, screw it, we'll write our own. So we wrote one in this kind of enemy journalese, cut and pasted it literally into the NME, photocopied it so it looked like it was real, using this matching font on a computer.
And people bought it.
Sent it around, and people bought it, and we started getting AR guys coming to our shows. And that was before the internet, so you couldn't really check the stuff out as to whether or not it was real. That was 1992, 93.
And then to impress those people, you hired... Or did you say that you claimed that you were auditioning dancers for a video at one of your gigs?
That's
and
right.
So people were dancing at your gigs.
That's right.
Genius.
Yeah. And all kinds of shenanigans, really, which goes... There's a long tradition of it in entertainment, whether it's Joe Meek did it in the 50s. Well, the Beatles did it as well. You know, that they bought... The allegation is that their first single was bought into the charts by their manager, who owned a record store. Surprise, surprise. Elvis did it. Frank Sinatra did it with the Bobby Soxer girls who followed him around. So you got to have a bit of impetus to get something rolling. It's harder to do now because the fascination for me today is the way the internet's changing our knowledge and the way we view the world. So it'd be quite difficult to do that today because you could cut and paste your little NME review and someone could search it online and go, well, this doesn't really exist, and you'd be exposed as fraudulent. Mm-hmm. However, at the same time, there's lots of other things that are fake that people think are real. But, you know, Photoshop.
Yep.
It's easier than ever to do. So if you can think of, you know...
I think it was cheeky. I don't think it was anything kind of really, really bad behind it. I think it's a great idea.
Well, in the academic world, it would be considered academic fraud.
Yes.
And I'd get fired for it if I was doing that in a book or a...
Be an unsigned band trying to get some attention.
Exactly. It would make a really good journal article, actually. To explore that, because that's a great case study that we could. I'm sure. I mean, there's so many examples of fraud in the music business that are sort of, what's the borderline between fraud and marketing?
Yeah.
In fact, I'm going to write that down and do it. That's brilliant. Thank you very much for that.
Pleasure. So you signed the record deal while you were kind of in a relationship with Louise, and we won't delve too much into this, but...
That's all right, I'm over it now, so delve away.
Yeah, no, I mean, I interviewed Billy Burnett, and he was in Fleetwood Mac for eight years, and he knew the band during the kind of rumours time, and I asked him how that album ever got made. How can you be creative in that situation? There was obviously a kind of, it was a pretty difficult time for you, but then you were having to go off on tours and like stay on tiny, you know, tour bus and stuff like that. How do you think that affected your kind of creativity in the band? And how did you compartmentalise your personal relationships with people in the band and actually the music side of things?
Well, like most difficult things in life, it turned out, it depends on how you view it. At the time, I was heartbroken, and I was in a situation where myself and this person had been together for 7 years, and I was very much in love with Louise, and we just got a record deal, we just got our album, it had gone in the charts, it had gone gold, and then we broke up, and it was psychologically difficult, I'm not going to deny that, and I kind of coped with it by turning into the biggest arsehole to be in a band with it's possible to be, because I felt since I'd started the whole thing they couldn't fire me.
Yeah.
And then I guess I started looking, and that went on for quite a while actually. And I did later, I have made amends to them both since then. I hope I think they're okay with that. As it,
you babysit the kid.
The way
the
book ends.
Yeah, that's great.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
It made one of my best friends cry. Actually,
yeah, I can see that, yeah.
So yeah, that's all come out of it. But I said to her as part of writing the book, I said, write what you like. Because, you know, I kind of owe you in that respect. And I'm glad that What could have happened is Louise could have gone off and, you know, met somebody really cool, which is what happened in another band when they broke up. I think all those bands, certainly Echo Belly, Sonia had a relationship with a guitarist, and then they broke up, and then she saw somebody else, and it was in the papers, and then she saw somebody else, and it was in the papers. At one point, she was rumored to be dating Sean Lennon and all this stuff. And yeah. I was like, wow, if Louise was doing that, that would just destroy me.
Absolutely,
but she's not. She's with somebody who I know is a really great guy, yeah. which is Andy.
Yeah, yeah.
So
yeah.
I may have be having a, rather be a little bit too up close than I prefer it to be. But you're going to have to go through this.
Because it must have been.
So I did.
It must have been so difficult. Because on one hand, you've just signed your record deal.
Yeah.
You know, and all the dreams you probably want are coming true. And on the other hand, you've got to deal with this difficult situation. Well, how did it affect creativity? I mean, talk about like band practice and stuff like that.
There were some difficult moments. There was a couple of standoff moments when I didn't behave very well. There was a song that I wanted an element in, and they didn't think it was very good, and it's almost. Got quite close to getting a bit sort of aggravational at one point. And then we had a producer at the time, and he said, well, no, it's not very good, it's not going in, and that sort of solved that.
Okay, so that
it's just a learning curve, really.
Yeah.
Well, the way I coped with it was I got drunk and took a lot of drugs. What I should have done was taken some counselling, I now realise, because that is a difficult thing to get. Fame itself, Louise describes it brilliantly. Fame is a mental health condition. It's a form of mental illness. It really is.
Mm.
And not that we were famous, but well, we, you know, we did.
Well, no, you had a certain big profile,
kind of,
yeah.
You know, that sort of that experience is a mental health condition, and I would recommend anybody, students today, who are starting to get attention, and who I can see are going to go. Big. I usually take them to one side and go, look after yourself, and just have someone you can talk to who's a qualified counsellor. You don't have to go and do therapy, but find a way that works for you, whether it's cognitive behaviour therapy or a confidant and an advisor that you can talk through things with, because it's really important to have a clear head, and you never know what's going to happen, and you are going to get put in a position where all your decisions are analysed publicly in great detail, and a lot of people aren't going to like what you do, either through jealousy or maybe it's not, you know, maybe they just don't like it because it's not very good, and they're right about that, and other people will read it, and your private life is going to be public, so that's not a normal scenario, so you therefore need to take not normal remedies for that,
yeah.
Which and normal people see counsellors and get help. So if you're in that scenario where it's not normal, I always recommend people do that, whether you're an actor or anybody. I think it's really healthy to be able to talk through anxiety and fear and things like that in any circumstance, and I think some methods are healthier than others, but certainly my approach, which was just to get drunk a lot, wasn't necessarily the best one, although it got me through to some extent. And
it's an understandable kind of reaction, though, to those circumstances,
I guess sort of bad. It's also a thing about just like behaving not very well as well. I mean, it's quite tempting when you're in a scenario where things are kicking off. So you're successful, you're young, you've got money, you're getting attention, you're traveling around, and your ego is being boosted. It can be quite tempting, and I see it a lot, just to behave like a complete idiot. And I certainly found that temptation difficult to resist. And when I see it in other people, my heart goes out. I'm like, oh, this is really just sort of, you're just acting out of fear. And so I would encourage anyone who's in a scenario where you feel slightly out of control, or things are going in a way that you're not sure how it's going to work out, or you feel under pressure or anything like that, to get some assistance with it, because there's a lot out there now. One of the great things about the internet is information's opened up. You don't have to seek this stuff out. You can just go, you know, browse and look at things like cognitive behavioural therapy or whatever you want, whatever suits you, really. It's important to keep grounded, that's what I'm trying to say. And the creativity would have been better if I would have been more grounded. That would be the one thing I'd say, that if you are a creative, there's this kind of myth that creatives are all slightly loopy, which I certainly bought into, and the people that I loved, whether it's John Lennon or Bob Dylan or Bob Marley or any of those people, you know, we look at them and they're all people who've gone through phases. I mean, Pink Floyd, we mentioned earlier, there's a lot of commonalities between creative thinkers, people who think differently, and different ways of viewing the world, which today we call some form of, whether it's a mental illness or a unusual viewpoint or eccentricity.
Yep.
Right? Mm-hmm. So it's a natural part of the whole process. In one way, you're encouraged to be eccentric so you can think things differently and come up with something new and entertaining. But if you buy into that too much, it can be quite damaging. And I think we know a lot more about it today than we used to do. So keeping eccentricity under control is a good. Having moments when you can be creative and let ideas flow freely, and at the same time pull things in. So within the band there were some issues, but we got through that largely through me just acting out and then putting up with it.
Hypothetically speaking, how would you have responded to what you just said there if someone older said, oh, maybe do think about doing this, that and the other, given that you're in the centre of kind of the whirlwind of Britpop and stuff like that affected so much culture? How do you think you responded to
that? I'd have been really grateful for that. I wish I would give anything for the 49-year-old me to go and see the 29-year-old me.
Yep.
And sit him down and go, look, this is what's happening. This is a way through this. I'd give anything for that. Because, well, I'd have a lot, you know, I'd have a lot more to give.
Yeah.
Financially and all kinds of different ways if I would have had that. But it's tricky. People at that time didn't know. You know, we've got to remember, we're only now just realising some of the abuses that went on in the music industry in the 80s and 90s and prior to that. So that's the backstory. It is an abusive, back to the money trench issue. It isn't a potentially abusive industry. There hasn't been any safeguarding. There still isn't. Look, Amy Winehouse is a brilliant example.
Hmm.
We still don't know how to deal with this stuff, even in outside the music or the entertainment industry. And I think someone who had the authority to, who'd been where I'd been, who just could have sat me down and gone, right, here's a few things that are going on. I think I would have probably, I like to think I'm not so dumb that I wouldn't have listened to that. It's about identifying with people and finding common ground and trusting people, which is part of life's journey, I suppose. And
What are your positive views around that time? Do you look back on that time fondly?
I do. I loved the travel that we did. The travel was amazing. And I got to see all around the world. I loved the fact that people heard music that we wrote together in a crappy little rehearsal room in the rain. The rain would literally come in the rehearsal. It was like the Elephant's Graveyard in the old Tarzan movies. The rain would sheet down the door in the rehearsal room.
And then you apply it.
We'd be rehearsing in there. And then, yeah. And then
REM, Radiohead, Manix.
And this is just Camden. It's what most of them, a lot of them were like in Camden at that time. And so all of that is amazing. And if you have to be grateful for that. And you can't put conditions on how it happens, ultimately. The fact that it's happened is a great, fantastic privilege. And the other thing I learned from it, which I still believe, is always stay friends. If you're in a, just on a personal thing, if you're in a relationship and you do break up and you have something in common, whether it's kids or a band or anything, if you can stay friends with your ex, I mean, I think Lou and I and Andy, we're all really good friends now, and we have been for a long time. But there's an element of a relationship, and anybody who's listened to this who has an ex-partner that they're still friends with will understand that. All the questions have been answered, so it's quite a freeing relationship. If you can stay friends with an ex, it's great. It's usually a really good relationship because there's no. It's just like there's nothing to get in the way of just good, honest friendship.
Yeah,
and I recommend that highly if possible.
Louis said, "Going on stage is the most escapist thing you can do." What do you see as your creative outlet now that you don't play live
No,
at all, do you?
Yeah, I've kind of stopped playing. I played at a friend's wedding,
right,
a few years ago, and that was the last time I picked up an instrument in anger.
Did you find it an escapist thing? Are you that kind of extrovert person?
Yeah, definitely. It's focus. The having something to focus on in life is a really positive thing, and there's nothing more focusing than standing in front of a lot of people who are watching you and doing your thing. And also being in a band combines that element of kinship as well. So you're in a little gang, you've got your sort of in-group mentality going on and identification between you. And so in one element, it's kind of you're there and you've got a job to do and you know what you're going to do and you know it's good and all these people are here to enjoy you doing what you're doing. It is a brilliant way to spend an hour and a half, there's no question about that. It really is a... you can see why people get addicted to performance in that respect. Well, someone like Ken Dodd is still doing gigs. it's a great... You get a huge shot of lots of natural reward chemicals when you do that kind of thing.
Going back to your point you just made about Amy Winehouse, and is it right you played with Mannix when Richie Edwards was still in the band?
That's
is that right?
Right.
Tell us about that. Tell us what you remember about that.
We played on his last tour. And
was that Holy Bible then?
Yeah. I think so. He was really skinny. He'd been self-harming, so he had scars all up and down his arms. There was a lot of kind of fan worship going on, all kinds of... He was being stalked a little bit by some young women fans who were turning up.
Was this before or after the For Real?
This is after the For
Real.
Oh,
yeah, so right, people would have had self-harming and stuff like that. Okay, right.
Still going on. He spoke to him a couple of times. He was a perfectly nice guy, and it was dry backstage. There was no booze in his dressing room, if I remember rightly. And that's a great example of... Look at that band. How many people were employed by that band? How many records did they sell? What is the net worth of that band as an industry? And one of the key members of the whole project is unwell, mm-hmm. and then... I've spoken to them since, and I think their position is, yeah, he jumped off the bridge there.
That's what their view was, right? Okay.
And
because of the pressures of the industry, do you think, or
who knows?
Who knows? Yeah.
Because people do that for all kinds of reasons.
Yeah.
But that was allowed to happen. Shows you how naive we are at looking after our artists, which are the basic lifeblood of creativity. Mm. Without Amy Winehouse, there's no Amy Winehouse records to sell. Without Kurt Cobain, there's no Nirvana. It's without Elvis, John Lennon nearly went the same way,
yeah,
through acid. Bob Dylan did in 66. It's, you know, it's that combination, it's that curious combination of creativity and eccentricity, and you mix it with ego and drugs and media exposure. It's a very interesting phenomenon. There's quite a lot of academic study of it now, music, the relationship between music and madness. And I think you can actually look all the way back through history at people like Shaman, who are basically people who are seeing visions, which at one time we would have thought were ghosts or spirits, but now we probably realise are just hallucinations.
Yeah.
They're dancing around, and you've got the music going on in relation to shamanic practice, which is where a lot of sort of tribal rhythms come from. So it's about a long backstory. Like mm-hmm. all this stuff, there's a long backstory to it.
Mm-hmm.
It's a fascinating area, and I'm really glad that my job involves, to some extent, reading books about that stuff. That's quite a privileged position to be in, actually.
Talk about privileged positions. I want to talk about one day in your career when you're in Sleeper. And I know this happened because I took my sister to Euro Disney a few years ago, and there's an Aerosmith ride there. And as you're queuing up, there's a poster for a gig that's REM, Radiohead, the Cranberries, and you and Sleeper were playing. Mm. What do you remember of that day? That must have been amazing.
That was amazing. It was brilliant. And thank you for sending me the poster. That one of the great joys of teaching is I get photographs from students and former students going, oh, just seeing a little thing from your, from a ghost from your past, and here's a picture of it. Yeah, it was really scary. A great example of where a little bit of coaching in terms of how to deal with that would have come in handy, because playing to 80,000 people is not an easy thing to do.
That must have been quite a step up from other ones you played.
Yeah, we'd maybe done a couple of festivals at that point, but you know, maybe 10,000 was the biggest thing we'd done. And we got there, and it was just amazing to observe the backstage of a huge show like that. The stage was, there was no smoking on the stage, it was all carpeted, it was really beautifully put together. The stage sound was immaculate.
I bet, yeah.
You were a long way from each other. That was one thing I noticed. It was like you looking at Andy, seemed, you know, half a mile away on drums, and it was pretty scary. I was spent a lot of time before we went on stage in the loo, and whilst I was there, Michael Stipe came into our dressing room, and I'm not sure if Louise has put this in the book, but the bass player was spectacularly good looking young man.
This is in the book.
Oh, cool. Go on. Right. So I can take them.
Yeah.
So Michael clearly took a shine to Deed, and then we had this fantastic band discussion that was basically, mate, if ever there was time to take one for the team, it is now. And it was totally with Niall and I, because it was like, you know, it's you he wants, offer yourself to him. If it was me, I would, but you know, unfortunately, it's not. It's you. And I mean, Deed was a very, very, very good-looking young guy, and yeah, he would attract a lot of that kind of attention if we were out anyway. But he had more self-respect certainly than I did, and decided that wasn't an avenue he was going to pursue. So,
what did you do with that nervous energy before playing? I mean, you probably did you psych that up as like it's a big gig today? You know,
I don't think I dealt with that stuff very well at the time. I just felt nauseous a lot of the time. Got on stage, found it quite difficult to look up from my pedals. Just thought I'll do the best show I can. So we did all that. And after about the first song, I thought, right, I'm going to have to look up at some point. So I thought I looked to the side of the stage, first of all, looked across to the monitor desk, and who could I see there but Michael Stipe watching us? Because
really?
What I didn't realise was the REM are brilliant in that they watch all their support bands.
So, and he brought Louise on stage to sing Happy
Birthday.
That's
right, it was her birthday. It was I think it was her 30th that night.
Right.
And he brought her out, and she had 80,000 people sing Happy Birthday to her at Milton Keynes Bar, which was, we were stood at the side of the stage. I was stood at the stage left with in a sort of the celeb enclosure backstage with a few quite well-known people at the time. Yeah, that we knew that was going to happen because he knew it was Louise's birthday and said, get up. She didn't know it was going to happen,
right?
But we, if I remember rightly,
make sure she's there at that time.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, okay. A couple other cool things happened. I know Elvis Costello covered one of your songs, and tell us about how you end up being in on the soundtrack for Trainspotting.
Yeah,
because is it right that Blondie was asked to use Atomic
right.
in Trainspotting? She said no, so you were asked to do
That's
a cover
right,
of it.
Yeah.
Firstly, what was your brief for that? Was it to kind of just do exactly the same? And how is that allowed? Explain to us how that's allowed. If Blondie said no, you're not using this song, how is a cover allowed?
I think the basic idea was that Blondie wanted too much for it.
Or right.
The owner of the recording rights wanted too much for it. And we said we'd do it. We were in the studio anyway, and we said we'd do it so it sounded like them, so they'd get a kind of a cheaper version of Blondie, which is basically what we did. And
so you didn't kind of have artistic
no,
free reign
we
over
were,
it such
they,
yet
they cut it. Oh, this
right.
is what I'm guessing happened, right? I don't honestly know, but I get the feeling that they'd cut the film to that track, and so they wanted that track done as that track, whether it was Blondie or somebody else newer doing it in kind of homage. So that was why
right.
we did that. And then and we got to have an original song on there too, which was really nice.
Statuesque, wasn't it?
Statuesque, yeah. Which
in the bar scene, is it?
That's right, yeah, which was really cool. That was it's the guitar solo in it, which was really ace, because that was
yeah.
my part. And I was quite proud of that guitar solo, although the NME called it the worst guitar solo ever committed to vinyl.
Really?
Yeah. So
that's not one of the ones you made up, the reviews you made up?
No, that was a real review. That's why we had to make them up.
Wow, jeez, yeah, harsh.
The actual...
Screw him, it got featured in Trainspotting. So.
That's right. I mean, I loved that scene. It kind of fits it really well. Having done a bit of film and music stuff, I'm really glad that we got to be in that. It was a great experience. And
because post Sleeper that you've done, so the band split up, what, 97 was that?
Actually about 98, 99.
Oh, was it? Right, okay. It was a sad day, you know. I bought Nice Guy Eddie on cassette from Woolworths about 96. Mm. So yeah, it was a sad day when the band split up. Then after that, you've done some stuff. You were the musical supervisor on Telstar, Meek Story, yeah?
Yeah, yeah.
What did that entail?
So that project was going a long time, and it started off as a stage play. Telstar, as a movie, is an old project, and in the original read-through of the first script, Jude, this is how old it was, Jude Law, who was virtually, as I understand it, not very well-known actor at the time, was reading one of the roles, which is the young guy, Hines, who Joe Meek falls in love with. And then obviously Jude went on and did his thing, and it was a play, and then it finally became a movie. So it had been running a long time, and we knew there was a possibility of it being a film for a long time. So we kind of cleared the rights quite early on, which was lucky because there was a competing film project. They were after exclusive rights to the tunes, because you had to have the tunes, otherwise you couldn't make that film.
Right, okay.
And obviously without Telstar, you can't make Telstar. And so we had really good relationships with the people who own the copyrights, and fortunately they recognised that and stayed with the project, and the project got made, and I really like that film. I think it's pretty good. I worked on it with Anne-Marie Shields, who is Kevin Shields' sister, and we run a little music supervision company called musicformovies.org, and Anne-Marie's great. She's a brilliant person to work with. And she also managed My Bloody Valentine for a long time. So
right, okay.
She really knows her stuff.
Cool, yes. Great film. Okay, and other stuff that you've done post Sleeper, you were session guitarist for Katie Lang. What was that like working with her?
That was amazing. She has the most incredible voice. So what generally happens to me as a session player is I'll come up with a part and it'll be a little bit overcomplicated because I'm trying to impress. And then the singer will go, well, why don't you just turn it into a tune by doing this and sing it back to me? Which Louise would do a lot. And KD did that. And that was, occasionally you have those little golden moments when you're in the studio. My most golden music moment in the studio in my career, I had a few, but by far and away the best one was writing a part for one of the tracks I played for KD. And her sitting me down in a totally dry acoustic environment, singing it back to me, having taken one of the notes out to make it simpler, going, make it like this, this would be really cool, and just singing it to me. And it was shiver down the spine, hair on the back of the neck. It was an incredible moment to be sat in a dry room, just me and her, face to face, working this part out with her, singing it to me with the most beautiful voice I think I've ever heard.
What would a musician have learned from specifically, perhaps working practices you might have observed from working so closely with her?
That stuff. I'm sat in a room talking to you about working with KD Lang. She's not doing any interviews talking about working with Jon Stewart.
Mm-hmm.
She's the voice. She's the singer.
Yeah.
So as a guitarist, here's a tip, guitarists. As a guitarist, it's the voice people are listening to, not you. You are there to augment that voice. Unless you're in Led Zeppelin or one or two other bands, you're basically there, particularly if you're working as a session player, to work around the vocal. That's what people identify with. That's what they want to hear. And the best example of that, which I use a lot in teaching, is the first Elvis single, where Scotty Moore tramples all over it in the early versions. And then as they work it up, and he just plays a little two-note riff at the end of every line that Elvis sings. That's all right, mama. Note. That's all right for you. Doo-doo. That's all right, mama. That's how it works. It's voice, two-note riff, voice, two-note riff. And it's a great way to approach it, because you spend a lot of time learning scales and chops, and you want to throw them on the record to give good value, but actually a lot of the time what you need to do is back off a little bit and listen to what the singer's doing and work around that. And it took me a long time to learn that. We'd probably lost our record deal by the time I finally learned that.
Really?
Yeah. I spent a lot of time battling with Louise, going, I've got this really clever part, and she's going, well, I've got this vocal tune. And I never really understood that, which takes us to the start of the whole conversation. You know, I'm trying to be Kraftwerk or whatever. Or
she mentions that she went to bed one night and then she got up the next day and you put on like 72 guitar parts. Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah, but a lot of guitarists are like that, you know.
That's... Yes, that's right. And the truth is, people want to hear a voice. It's that's what people identify with. It's, and I'm a guitarist, so if you're a guitarist and you listen to this, I'm sorry for betraying the creed, but truth is important. Truth is out there. We've got to, sooner or later, you've got to bend to the knee of what is factual, and that's the case, I'm afraid. But you have to use that in a way that's going to help you. Once you understand that, life gets easier, because you're no longer battling with singers, you're working with them.
Cool. Okay, we'll begin to wrap up here. So since then, you've become a very well-respected academic. I know when you were a tutor of mine, some referred to you as the Stephen Fry of music.
Yes.
You've had stuff in The Guardian, you know, you've written about The Wire, the TV show, great programme. And I know that you've actually done some amazing stuff. You've been quite outspoken about, you know, been quite public that you were a member of Alcoholics Anonymous for quite a number of years.
Yeah.
And that I was listening to a very interesting interview you did the other day about it, and that how the 12 steps program is quite outdated because it lacks the same level of professionalism and safeguarding compared to cognitive behavioural therapy. Mm-hmm. And that it was written in the 1930s.
Yep.
And I think it's a quote from you, is it was absolutely the leading mental health technology of its day. I'm not sure that is the case today. What do you think is the solution to that, and what are you trying to do by raising this issue?
Well, we're living in a really interesting time, and it could be to do with alcoholism or addiction and recovery, or any subject, actually. But the internet has opened up knowledge. The fact that we're doing this interview now is a great example of that. And when I got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous in the year 2000, and I'll be forever grateful for that. I would recommend anybody, if anyone's got a problem with alcohol, which is a legal drug that about 10% of the people who use it find they have problems with it. So that's a separate debate. But if anybody does have a problem with it, go to AA, give it your best shot, and there's every chance it'll work for you. And I thoroughly recommend it. However, we do know more about alcoholism than we did when the book was written. The program of Alcoholics Anonymous, which was 1939. And there are lots of areas of inquiry in terms of evolutionary psychology that explain where alcoholism comes from. And there's lots of newer types of therapy, like cognitive behavioral therapy, that I think are slightly kind of forms of mental health and a little bit more realistic. The issue of God or higher power is central to the text of Alcoholics Anonymous in many people's practice of recovery, and that's a massive barrier for a lot of people. Abstinence is central to the program of AA, and I'm grateful to be abstinent and hope to continue to be abstinent. But that's also a problem for a lot of people. And there are ways around that now, and AA is a slightly closed system of thought, which is why it works. You need to revise your thinking if you have a drinking problem. So that's a part of the success of it, but it's not very responsive to new ideas. So I blogged about that, and there's a growing number of people that are doing the same. And the internet's just a massive opener. It's opened up knowledge. I liken it to sort of the early days of printing. I think it's YouTube is the equivalent to the Gutenberg Bible in terms of the way it's opened up knowledge. And anyone can have a YouTube channel now, which is brilliant, because things like a good comparison might be Scientology, which is just disappearing.
You've seen Going Clear?
Yeah.
Oh, man.
That was an amazing thing. And if you go on YouTube, there's just an absolute tidal wave of information that Scientology has been keeping out of the public realm for decades.
Hard to do these
all
days.
All there
it?
Now. It's all there. All the ex-Scientologists have got YouTube channels, and some of them are amazing. So AA's not Scientology. Don't get me wrong. It's a helpful thing, but it's a similar sort of battle over knowledge and new information versus old in respect of the recovery community. And some people in AA are resistant to that because they see their lives as dependent on the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, which for many people it is. So I'm not anti-AA.
Yeah.
I'm pro-choice.
Great answer. Thank you. And okay, we'll wrap up there. I mean, you've been helping people from when you kind of helped Louise find out that the guitar that had four strings was the bass, and teaching a course to, you know, through being a lecturer and a teacher and a tutor, an academic, and now you're helping people in other ways as well. So it's a pleasure to have you on here. You've been a great influence over a lot of the stuff that I've done as well. So I really appreciate you coming on the Stage Left podcast.
Well, that's really, really kind of you to say that. And I've listened to the podcast. I think it's great. And happy to do this again if you want to do another one at some point later on. And just good luck with everything. It's great to see, as I said at the start, people going out there and doing their own thing, and that's really what it's all about. So congratulations for that, and more power to you.
What do I do now? Are we going under? What did I do wrong? I thought we had it sorted. Is there someone else? Am I too familiar? Was it when I said I wanted to have children? Tore up all your photos, didn't feel too clever. Spent the whole of Sunday sticking you together. Now I'd like to call, but I feel too awkward. Something's need explaining. No one told me it was
more episodes featuring musicians who've worked with the likes of Fleetwood Mac, Bob Dylan, The Beatles, Michael Jackson, Elvis Presley, The Prodigy, Oasis, go to www.thestageleftpodcast.com, follow us on Twitter at The Stage Left Pod, or like us on Facebook at facebook.com/thestageleftpodcast. See you next time.